downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. The 2014 FIFA World Cup is now history, with Germany having become the first European team to win a tournament hosted in Latin America. And fittingly, we have two German scholars on the podcast this week to talk about the history of the World Cup, with a bit of commentary on this year's tournament in Brazil and the German triumph. Stefan Rinke is a professor of Latin American history at the Free University in Berlin and the author of a number of works on soccer in Latin America. And Kai Schiller is reader in modern European history at the University of Durham. He's the co-author of an award-winning history of the 1972 Munich Olympics and author of a recent book on the 1974 World Cup. Together, they are editors of a volume of essays covering the history of the tournament, titled The FIFA World Cup, 1930 to 2010, Politics, Commerce, Spectacle, and Identities. This is the best kind of edited volume. It offers a broad selection of essays written by experts in the history of each of the host countries, and these essays both give an in-depth and often revealing look at each of the tournaments, and they link together well with the other pieces in the book. So if you are looking for a single volume on the history of the World Cup, whether for a class you're teaching or for your own shelf of sports books, I recommend this book, edited by Kai and Stefan. Here's my interview with them. This week's guests on New Books in Sports are Kai Schiller. Kai, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting us.
And speaking to us from Berlin is Stefan Rinke. Stefan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Nice to be here.
So we start the episode by getting a bit of introduction about each of our guests, and I'll begin with Kai, who was a guest on the podcast a few years ago to talk about his book on the 1972 Munich Olympics. And at that time, Kai, you were in the midst of research on your book about the 1974 World Cup. And so I'll ask you to start what led you, knowing that your early research was on intellectual history, on refugee scholars. So what led you from that to studying the World Cup of your youth?
I think probably the love for football in the first place, and then probably also a sense that if you want to have an audience, you better pick a topic that is a bit more popular, and football is obviously very, very popular, and sports in general is a topic that has perhaps more relevance or more interest, at least among students and the wider public, than, say, 20th century intellectual history. It's not to say that I'm no longer interested in 20th century intellectual history, but it's just a different cup of tea, a cup of tea that is perhaps also a bit closer to my own sort of loves and interests. So that's how I moved into sports history.
And Stefan, I'll turn to you. You've published books and articles on a wide range of topics in Latin American history, from the colonial period and the revolutions to contemporary cultural history. You focused on a number of nations in the region. And so I'll ask you, what led you to your interest in Latin American history in general and in Latin American football?
Well, my interest in Latin American history stems from my general interest in history. When I was a small boy, I got hooked by history, and then later on, when I started studying, I found out that studying history in Germany, like in so many other countries, turns out to be a rather one nation sided thing. And I got interested in history beyond the borders of Germany, and I got a good teacher in Latin American history, and he attracted me, Hans-Joachim König from Eichstätt, and he attracted me to that field, and I got stuck with Latin American history. And as to Latin American football, that is quite obvious. If you study Latin America in the 20th century, you will hardly get around looking at football as a phenomenon which is not only culturally grounded, but also politically and economically very, very important. And so that's where I started investigating football in Latin America too.
And I'll ask you both, I presume that you were both satisfied by the result of this last World Cup.
Absolutely, yeah, of course. No, I was kind of hoping for it. Stefan and I went to a meeting at the Volkswagen Stiftung, and I think one of the last things we were asked there was when we gave papers and talks on the World Cup, and one of the last things we were asked was who we were actually hoping for. And I was, I think, the only one among the four people who were present there who were sort of who were giving papers, who was strongly in favor of Germany winning or hoping that Germany would do it this time. But Stefan, I think, was more interested in Chile winning. But he might be able to answer this himself better.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, the question wasn't whom we were hoping for, Kai, but it was rather whom we thought would win. And I said that I thought that Chile had very good chances, and they did not disappoint me. They did not disappoint me. You know how tight the match was against Brazil, and if they had marked the goal in the minute 119, they wouldn't have had to go to the penalties, and they would have been in the quarterfinals, and obviously the team to play in the semifinals, they would have given us a harder time than Brazil. But I'm very happy about the German win, no doubt about that.
Okay, Stefan. So I was going to ask, you haven't gone native, so to speak, in your fan interest.
No.
Okay.
and that would also be a very, very strange thing. You know, every Latin American is obviously very much with their own nation's team, and I'm with mine, and everybody accepts that. But many, many people from Latin America, from Brazil, Chile, and so on, where I have many friends, have given me feedback, and they congratulated me on the win of the German team. And they said that people in Chile, for example, were celebrating with fireworks that the German team had won the final, which really impressed me.
Excellent.
Well, let's turn to the book. And in this volume of essays, so you two are the editors of this collection of essays, and this came out of an academic conference held last year in 2013 in Zurich. And the conference was hosted by FIFA, and this publication, the volume, was supported by FIFA. And so as you both know, FIFA is the subject of much criticism, including from scholars of football. And so I'll ask you to start how your work with FIFA went in producing this volume.
Well, we first tried to get funders both in the United Kingdom and in Germany to pay for a conference of this type. And unfortunately, you know, given that we were covering 19 World Cups, we have 21 contributions. And we wanted to have experts either from the country that hosted the conference to give a paper, or experts on those countries. So we would have a very pretty international audience, which would make this quite an expensive conference to hold. And so we had a hard time, you know, getting the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft or the British Academy to fund this. And our applications for funding were unsuccessful. And for my 74 book, I had worked in the FIFA archives, and I had just mentioned it to the archivist that we were planning such a conference. And at some point when I'd already sort of thought, I think it was November 2012, that the whole thing was pretty much dead and we wouldn't be able to have that conference, and obviously not a book in the aftermath, I got an email from somebody at FIFA who had found out about the conference and had said, well, is that conference going to happen? And I sort of picked up the phone and called them up and asked them whether, basically I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't write an email. Maybe I should talk to this person on the phone. And it turns out that Alexander Koch, who we also thank in the preface to the volume, was very, very interested. And so we ran the proposal by him, and eventually FIFA said, actually, we could fund this. And we could fund this, and we could hold this at FIFA headquarters in Zurich. And we obviously were absolutely clear that this meant that there might possibly be dangers related to this in terms of, you know, are we going to be used by FIFA? To what extent are we sort of fig leaf, perhaps, for FIFA, which always gets in the news in a sort of negative sense? But in many ways, our fears seemed unjustified, in the sense that there was never any sort of attempt at controlling what we were whom we were inviting. We invited scholars who were quite critical of FIFA. If you look at the volume, for instance, David Goldblatt is in it, who's very, very critical of FIFA. Alan Tomlinson has written very, very critical books on FIFA. Chris Boltzmann has written on South Africa in a very, very critical fashion. So we were quite impressed by how open FIFA was to, you know, to sponsor the conference, invite these speakers, and then also in facilitating the publication. And there was never any attempt to interfere with the conference in terms of, you know, who was speaking, what they were saying, also with the and with the publication. FIFA helped with editing the volume, with copy editing the volume, because we had to get it out very, very quickly. Obviously, the conference was in April 2013, and I think the deadline for the contributions was July, August 2013, so just a few months later, and we hadn't had FIFA copy editing helping us with, you know, making the text ready for publication also, because neither of us is a native speaker, which makes it perhaps a bit, you know, native English speaker, which makes it even harder. If we hadn't had FIFA copy editing, we would not have been able to get this out in time for the World Cup. And Not once was there an attempt sort of to interfere or to, that smartly people never tried to do this. And I don't know, I found it, how would I say this? Was it a prize worth paying having FIFA's name attached to it? I think it was, because in the end, the end result sort of suggests that it was actually FIFA was very generous. Yeah, I mean, you can say they have so much money, maybe it's easy for them to be generous. But I think that's perhaps what I can say about this.
Yeah, I would fully underwrite what Kai has just said. I was actually impressed by openness of the people at FIFA, because obviously one shouldn't forget FIFA is not only Blatter or the upper echelon of the presidential board, but rather many people who also have an interest in showing that the association has an interest in scholarly research, has also an interest in a critical discussion of FIFA's history. And I was impressed by that. And I thought that, you know, there are obviously more sides to FIFA than we usually get to know from the press.
Kai, you had mentioned that David Goldblatt was a participant at the conference, and he wrote one of the opening essays for the book. And in that essay, in the early pages of the essay, he has this interesting phrase that the history of the World Cup must be written as an emotional history. And so can you talk about this idea of how it shapes our understanding of the history of the World Cup to pay attention to not just politics and economics, but also to emotions?
I mean, that is a line of research which has recently opened up in historiography. It has become a broader field of inquiry, the emotional history. And I always thought from the very beginning that that will go a long way in explaining the attraction and also the high feelings that go along with the sport. And so I think this is a very promising field of research, although, of course, as a historian, one is always a little uptight or a little reluctant in going too much into the psychological field of study. If you talk about emotions, emotional history, then of course, how will you measure that? How can you find out about what is going on in the people, in the spectators, in the players, and so on? But what you can do is, of course, an analysis of the discourse discourse around the event of the media, of the journalists, of the players in their interviews, and also of the people being interviewed. So that would be, I think, a very promising approach, not only for the most recent World Cups, but also for the older ones, because what is very astonishing is that already at the very beginning, we find that football, already in 1930 in Uruguay, had the masses, or really caught the masses, that there were massive amounts of people who were go to the matches, especially when the home team played. And so football was especially strong in stirring up national emotions, you know, the emotions of nationality, which are hardly ever stirred up in such a manner as when it comes to events like the World Cup or other matches by national teams. So I think that there's, especially in that regard, as to football and national identity, quite a bit that still needs to be researched. And maybe Dave Goldblatt is going that way right now. But obviously, we talked about that during the conference, and we were all agreed that this would be a promising field of how to approach the history of football from a new angle.
Stefan, let me ask you, following up on that, because you wrote the essay on the 1930 World Cup in Uruguay. So today, when we see images of nationalism or how do you say it, nationalist emotion among World Cup fans, you typically see someone with their face painted in the colors of the national flag. They're wearing the colors of the flag. They're wearing the shirt of the national team. Looking back at 1930, and you mentioned that you have this already in 1930, this sense of nationalism and nationalist emotion. How was that expressed? How was that demonstrated in 1930?
Yeah, well, that was expressed differently, of course. People wouldn't run around with the colors of the flag in their faces, but emotions were no less very strong, especially when it came to the games between the immediate neighbors, you know, this derby kind of games between Uruguay and Argentina. Those were highly charged with nationalist feelings, and people would do what the more violent fans still do today. They would beat up each other, and they would cheer nasty things to the antagonists. And so that was one thing, how it was expressed. But the other thing was also using the use made of the event by the governments. And for example, the Uruguayan government used the fact that they were the very first to present what was to become a big tradition. Nobody knew it in 1930 that this was going to happen. It was still kind of a exploratory championship, but when still the Uruguayan government made sure to point out how highly developed the country already was, and how much it was ahead of even some of the European countries, and deducted from there the fact that Latin America and Uruguay especially would have a great future, would become world leaders due to their role in football. So this is where you can see that the two dimensions, you know, the popular emotion of nation, national, or we might also say patriotism, and on the other hand, governmental use of employing football to present themselves to the world, also to attract tourists. That was quite a very modern way of promoting the event in 1930. You can see that these two dimensions are already there in the very beginning, and it struck me that you can see these strains already so early.
And that was something I noticed throughout all of the essays, is this tension between the South American and the European countries.
Yes, that is obviously pretty strong, and it was strong again this year when we followed the World Cup, and how much the Latin American countries were proud of their achievements of gaining ground or getting ahead of the European teams. And of course, in a continent which is usually known for nothing but their catastrophes, football is one of the very few export factors or export products, so to say, which is positively connoted. And as such, football has a very important role, especially when it comes to presenting Latin America or presenting one country to the world. And we noticed that in 2014, we could have seen that, or we have seen that already in 1930 and in the many World Cups. For Latin American teams, it's always not only being the rivals of the other teams in general, but there's always this rivalry against the European masters, so to say, or the former teachers who once brought football to the continent. And there's always this dimension too. And only in the second line comes the rivalry against the neighboring countries. And this is why it surprised me so much to receive so many congratulations to the German victory for this year's World Cup. My idea had been that the Latins would rather keep their fingers crossed for Argentina, you know, in this game, but that was obviously not the case.
Mm-hmm. So one other theme that I noticed in the essay on Uruguay in 1930 is the desire to build state-of-the-art stadiums as a sign of progress, and this is opposed to concerns within the host country about the expense of those stadiums. So this is something that is present in nearly all of the tournaments, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's always obviously national elites, national governments who use football to enhance identification, national identification, and you know, having a World Cup or having such a spectacle, that's an occasion to do this. The Olympics, I think, is not very very different in that respect, and that comes with expenditure that cannot be spent on other perhaps very basic amenities like we had in Brazil with regards to public transport, education, healthcare, and that also then obviously in this first instance led to the protests that we've seen, not so much with regards to the World Cup, but a year before at the Confed Cup. And I think That's something that probably needs to be rethought for the future, in the sense that if a state cannot provide the bare minimum, then it's going to be increasingly hard for them to sell, you know, the building of state, in particular white elephants like we have in Brasilia or Manaus, where we don't have first division teams that would use the stadium, or we had similar incidences in South Africa, 2010. World Cups always are costly. That is to say, the balance sheet will never sort of will never turn out to be positive for the host country. I think it's a myth to suggest that World Cups start up the economy or give a boost to the economy. The reality is that I think studies by Szymanski and others have shown this very, very clearly. Menik was also at our conference, Wolfgang Menik, World Cups never come cheaply, and they do not really help the economy. And therefore, governments will have to, make it clear to their publications that this is not, the World Cup is not a free lunch, you know.
May I add a word to
yeah,
that?
Yeah,
the Brazilian program of building stadiums has come under so much fire and under so much criticism, and there are obviously good reasons for criticism. But I think what is often forgotten is the fact that Brazil, ever since the late 19th century now, has been trying to give infrastructure from the centers at the coast, that is to say Sao Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, and of course in former times also Salvador de Bahia, to the regions which are far off. And as we all know, Brazil is a continent in itself, because of its size. And so the idea of using these events, of using the big sports events in order to give a push to this policy of infrastructure development is not so far-fetched as some European critics might think. Of course, here in Europe, we are very much accustomed to having a very good railroad and road system, and you can go anywhere you want in a very short time. But not so in Brazil, where regions like the Amazon or Fortaleza or what have you are still very much underdeveloped, and where money needs to go to these poorer sections of the country in order for them to make a progress. So the idea of the government to decentralize the cup and to actually have games there was not so far-fetched, and I think there were good intentions behind that, because one of the major problems of Latin American polities, not only in Brazil, but you can take that to Argentina, or you can take that to Chile or to Colombia or what have you, is that politics for historical reasons have always been centered on the capitals, which are growing by leaps and bounds. You know, in countries such as Argentina or Colombia, it's even worse, because especially Chile, where you only have this one big city which is growing and growing and growing and attracting everything, and then the rest is simply forgotten. And of course, that creates many, many problems for the other parts of the country. So we have to look at this idea of building the stadiums in this larger context of developing ideas. Of course, what has to be criticized is the fact that the many infrastructural projects, which were also part of the planning, were not completed, and that much of the money which was intended to be spent on that finally ended up in some nebulous, corrupt veins. And this is obviously a very big problem which needs to be criticized. But the idea itself, and so I wouldn't say that those are all white elephants, especially not in Brasilia. Brasilia has a very good plan of how to use the stadium after the event. Of course, they do not have a first league football team, but this is a growing city, and there are many events like rock concerts and so on, and other sports events which will be staged there in the future. It is different in Manaus, it is different in Fortaleza, of course. But as I said, you look at the broader picture, take into account the intentions of the government, and then you can go on to criticize what really has to be criticized.
But could you not have built that's just to add on to this. I mean, given that it's the Brazilian taxpayer that carries the can for this expenditure, could you not have built the infrastructure without the stadia? I mean, could you not have spent the same amount of money on this just by building the infrastructure without having a World Cup? That I find difficult.
Yeah, well, thank you for that critical question. But it was obviously also a big interest in the states involved in Amazonia, or also in the federal district, to get this games. You know, this is also a prestige factor. It's all politics has always been about panem et circenses, and this has always been has also been a very important factor in the game. So, you know, you cannot only judge it all from the rational standpoint, as you already said. You know, giving or applying for a World Cup by countries such as Russia or Qatar, of course you can criticize that from a European point of view. But then where would you end up? You would end up with having your World Cups only in France, England, or Germany, or Spain for that matter. You couldn't even go to Italy, because there the fans are too brutal. And then, you know, where do you end up? You only have the World Cups here in the European countries, which do already hold the infrastructure. And you can't go anywhere else. But if you really want FIFA to be, and this is part of the fascinating aspect of the association, that it always pretended to be really a global association. And that already from 1904 on. So this is a very long history. And they lived up to their claim by broadening their membership and opening themselves up to allowing other continents also to hold this big event, you know. And if you do that, if you really want that, if you really want globalization and internationalization, it doesn't come without a price. And part of the price to be paid is to play according to the rules of the countries that are joining you and that are trying to compete with you. So I guess, you know, coming back to the questions, couldn't they have built the infrastructure without building the stadium? Of course they could. But would they have done so? No, they wouldn't, because then other projects would have been at the fore, and there would have been many political reasons for postponing that. So, you know, at times, you know, look at the German example, which you studied so well, Kai, in your own works on the 1972 Olympics. Of course, you know, one could say, did it need the Olympics to make Munich modern? Couldn't they have just done that without the Olympics? Of course they could have, but they didn't, because it needs these kind of events in order to gain this this boost in order to make development happen. And I think that's what the governments of Lula and Dilma had hoped for. It didn't happen for different reasons, which need to be criticized, but the idea in itself has not to be condemned from the outset.
So moving back into history, you break the essays into blocks of tournaments or periods, and I want to ask about the periodization you set forth in the book. After looking at the initial tournaments in the 1930s, you then group the four tournaments from 1950 to 1962 in a section that you title Between Tradition and Modernity. So can you talk about these the characteristics of these four World Cups in this middle period as being caught between the past and the modern?
Well, the grouping to me seemed, when you look at these World Cups, you think to a great deal they help traditional societies to move into modernity. Would say that's clearly the case for 1950, yeah, and for 1962, or they move within the kind of tension between modernity and idyll, such as the 1958 World Cup in Sweden. And given that, for instance, television, yeah, wasn't really that important until 1966, that suggests to me, for instance, that the World Cups between 1950 and 1962 sort of represent a kind of like, you know, somewhat looking back to the 30s as well as a sort of looking forward, using the World Cup to modernize. The German World Cup, obviously, in 1954 is a special case because of the tension with the past and the sort of lost war. I think you can probably take these periodizations apart in some ways, but in other ways, I think they make quite a lot of sense. In particular, the tension between tradition and modernity, as represented in 1958, as well as in 1950 in Brazil, and the way it is being sort of received, particularly the Maracanazo, the relatively small event that the World Cup is in Chile in 1962, if you look at it on the world stage, suggests to me that these World Cups were different, say, from the pre-war World Cups, where I think there's a clear sort of time break between, obviously, 38 and 50. So that suggested to me that, you know, also because of the way the 34 was used for political means, 38 was used equally in a sort of took place in a charged political atmosphere, to look at those separately, whereas the ones that follow after in terms of the periodization seemed to me preparing for the what I call the sort of hyper-commodification of the World Cup that was to come in the last section, multiculturalism and commercialization. That's why I entitled it Before the Gold Rush. There's a famous article by Alan Tomlinson on 74 as being the last World Cup before the Gold Rush. I sort of modified it. So we modified this slightly by taking 82 as part of this as well. Periodizations are what they are, and I suppose they have strengths and they have weaknesses. But I thought in the end what we suggested is defensible, Bruce.
I think there are good reasons for saying that, and Kaya's already singled out most of them. But let me add just one point, because if you look at the media coverage we have in the in this period, obviously radio is a very very strong medium, which does reach regions of the countries which had formerly not taken part in the. In the media hype around the tournament, and which now could take part. That is to say, the Maracanazo of 1950 was not only an event which stayed in Rio de Janeiro, but was also felt live and at the same moment in most of Brazil. And this is the modern aspect of it. But then if you look, as Kai already said, at 1958, the stadiums, these little village kind of matches that you would see, that is obviously still a kind of a traditional element in it. And so this is really an in-between time, which one can see there.
I think the general problem that you have when you organize such a book, and also don't forget, we had to do this very, very quickly. Is to think about possible ways of, obviously you want to keep the chronology, because we wanted, I mean, one of the main ideas was, you know, to have scholarly articles on each World Cup. If you read David Goldblatt, he suggests a different type of structure, but at the same time, we couldn't sort of say, Goldblatt just sets the agenda for us. So I think Goldblatt has an important break in 82. He says, 82, if you look at the title of the article by Albrecht Sonntag, France 98, a watershed World Cup, we should have another structure there. So this was tentative, you know, in a way. And the organization of the World Cups is tentative. And so what this book, in a way, is about is you know how do these national contexts sort of interact with this global phenomenon, and how does this global phenomenon expand? I mean, there's certainly I see this book as a kind of stepping stone towards a sort of further towards a history of football in the 20th century, like David Goldblatt has written one, but you can think about writing another one. There would have been more space perhaps to write about FIFA. There would have been more space to write about globalization. There should have been perhaps an article on globalization, and a further one on FIFA that looks more at the later developments of FIFA as well. So
let me ask this question. So sticking with periodization and key turning point World Cups or watershed World Cups, is there a World Cup or multiple tournaments where you look at it and you say, that was not a watershed? We can't look at that tournament as being, we don't see anything really significant in terms of being a turning point in the history of World Cups. Yes, we see trends continuing from previous tournaments, but there's not anything extraordinary in terms of the history of the tournament.
Yes, I could say, you know, 1934, 1938 were not that outstanding, I would guess. And I would say 1930 and 1950, they were very important in terms of 1934 being the first one, 1950, of course, being the first one after the after the Second World War, when the tradition was taken up again. Then you have 54 and 58, 62 and 66, which are also, you know, more in this transitive mode that we've been just been talking about. And then as you come to the 70s, of course, there is I would say a major rise, and then as Kai has already pointed out, with the media coverage in the 70s and 80s, and with the commercialization in the 90s, I would say that 74 in because of the, or 70 already because of the TV coverage, and then 1990 again because of the commodification of the sport, do become new stepping stones. And again, 94, 98, 2002, perhaps 2002 then again because of its of the World Cup going abroad or going to Asia for the first time. That is also a major turning point, a major watershed, I would say. And as is 2010 in South Africa. So that would be my evaluation, but of course that depends on the perspective, and that's also what the fun that history writing is always about. You can discuss hours and hours about different viewpoints, and we did that, and as I said at the opening, FIFA left us the freedom to do so, and that was the good thing about the conference, and it's also the good thing about the volume which we now have at hand.
So your book doesn't have a chapter on Brazil 2014, but I want to ask you both, knowing that you you paid close attention to this tournament, what themes or issues from previous World Cups stood out most to you now having participated in this conference, having put these essays together in a volume? What really stood out as you watched this year's tournament?
What stood out? You know, I would say the first thing is the quality of the football. As compared to other World Cups, number of goals scored, that was something which really surprised me in a positive manner. I hadn't thought that possible. I thought that would rather be more of the boring games, and so that was very good. Also, the quality of the Latin American teams impressed me, and I was very happy about that. Also, what it stirred up in the Latin American countries in terms of happiness and joy. And also, what stood out to me and what I somehow predicted also at this event at the Volkswagen Stiftung was that the big protests did not show up again during the World Cup. I had said that that was my prediction because I thought that during the World Cup, Brazilians would not, or the protesters would not be able to mobilize the same kind of dissatisfaction. And that was actually true. And I thought, again, it showed how football, for the moment that it is being played, can cover up deep divisions and structural problems of a society, like in the Brazilian case now. And of course, these problems have not been created by the Soccer World Cup, and they couldn't have been solved by the World Cup neither, but are rather long-range problems of now about almost 200 years of independent Brazil, and which need to be overcome by long-range measures of the Brazilian governments in the future. But then another point which also struck me as being very new was this kind of open voice dissatisfaction with FIFA, of course, having now become a real the bad guy in the whole game, and this has also struck me, and I was asking myself again and again what is happening there, and is it really such a black and white picture which we sometimes get presented, and shouldn't we be a little bit more critical about that? So those are the factors that most struck me, and of course also the very idea that sport and politics are so closely interrelated is something which is more or less a very broad a very broad element of continuity in the history of the World Cups.
Yeah, I think equally the quality of the football played, the increasingly open criticism of FIFA in the stadia, also the booing of Dilma, as well as of Blatter, the kind of open criticism. I think that we didn't have that when we didn't have that in South Africa. It struck me as, how would I say this? As I said, I think what struck me particularly about it is to what extent it's a spectacle that is really sort of organized, sanitized, made to look pleasant for the eye. You know, the camera angles that we got of the fans that wore their whatever the flags on their cheeks and the funny costumes, how all of this has become a sort of a mega party, a mega event, and that in some ways arouses our emotions, makes us participate, draws us in emotionally, but equally it happens and it sort of ends after 3 weeks and we miss it for a few days and we watch, I mean, I don't know, I watched probably 64 games, and but then we equally forget about it as well and we move on to something different. And I think it struck me, well, what struck me in particular is the kind of, as I said, the kind of sort of emotions that football is able to create, or that the kind of way it is presented when you're not in the stadium, when you just watch it on the television, the spectacle, to what extent it sort of arouses our emotions and lets us partake in this global festival and this global party, but which then, like a caravan that, you know, comes into town, leaves town, and leaves us, I wouldn't say sort of slightly sober or disappointed, but which doesn't have anything for us to hold on to. For instance, I think, like, for instance, that fourth World Cup win, in some ways, I mean, this is very early to say that, but in some ways it didn't possess the kind of emotional qualities that perhaps other World Cups, old World Cup wins, possessed for Germany. But maybe that's just over the top and exaggerated.
No, that's actually something that I was interested in hearing about, is how this, or even comparing it to when Germany hosted the World Cup in 2006 and won third place, was, you know, how would you compare the reaction of Germans this year as opposed to 8 years ago?
I think Stefan is better placed because he lives in Germany, so he knows a bit more what's been going on.
Well, you know, Kai is right in that sense that 2006, it was all new when we first had this kind of overboarding happiness and joy and national pride going on. Now in 2010, it was more or less a repetition, but a mighty one for that. I mean, the welcome that the populace gave to the team here in Berlin a few days ago was really impressive, and people came from all over Germany to take part in that. And of course, there's also always this danger, I would say, of some people getting too proud of that win and of getting too nationalistic about it. And so one might say there are also some caveats about it. But in the long run, or on the whole, I would say people were pretty much relaxed and were very happy. And if I look at my children, they have now for the first time lived through their first World Cup triumph. And I told them about the way I felt when I was a kid, you know, in 90 and or in 74 especially. So it's all a long tradition which goes into family history. But talking about the emotional side, what most struck me during this World Cup was the week when I was in Ecuador, in Quito, and I was there when Ecuador played that their third and last game against France, which they tied 0-0, but that wasn't enough for them and they had to leave the tournament. And then I heard this radio reporter saying, you know, I was in a taxi then, and I heard this radio reporter saying, well, now the guys are all there out there on the field and they are crying, but they are crying like men. So that was what really struck me and what I will never forget about this tournament.
Well, we're okay. Almost out of time. I want to ask, so you have essays in the book about all of the World Cups of the past, but I imagine in the conference that you talked about the World Cups of the future, the World Cup that's scheduled to take place in Russia and Qatar. And I'll just ask if anything stood out from your discussions at your conference about looking ahead to Russia and Qatar.
I think what stood out in the discussions is, of course, you know, what kind of future FIFA has and what kind of reforms FIFA should undergo, if possible. And we had, you know, lots of discussions at the conference, you know, with David Goldblatt, for instance, and Alan Tomlinson and others, who have ideas on how to possibly reform FIFA. And, you know, for instance, by, you know, turning, you know, making FIFA truly democratic, by, for instance, doing things that the IOC has done, which is give a sort of age limitation to how long, you know, functionaries can serve, but all of that has already been rebutted at the FIFA Congress in Brazil. So that's not going to happen. That's not going to come in, you know, the time that can be served and in FIFA, in FIFA offices, that there should be a time limitation to this. I think I don't know. I'm really worried about what's going to happen to the World Cup in the future. I mean, I don't know whether you saw that, but today German politicians were already discussing. You see how politicized the World Cup is. Whether 2018 should be taken, whether the World Cup should be taken away from Russia as a kind of a move, because the European Union and the Americans can't really agree on sanctions against Putin's Russia, that whether maybe we take the World Cup away. It's obviously not in their hand to take the World Cup away. It would be FIFA, and FIFA obviously says that football stands above politics, and therefore it wouldn't act. I don't know. I'm really skeptical about the future. I think that's one of the things that comes out of 2014, even despite the German win, and because that, you know, I find it okay, enjoy that, but then there are other things where I see FIFA, I think, much more critically than I saw it before. I'm not sure. I only hope that there are voices within FIFA that are willing to address. And obviously the people we met at FIFA, we found them very interested in what we had to say and in these kind of discussions. And I hope that these voices will prevail and hopefully, you know, there'll be a rethink about, you know, where future World Cups go, or perhaps also, you know, where the ones that have already been awarded, whether they should stay where they actually are.
Yes, of course. I do remember the very heated discussions actually that we had, especially with the journalists who were participating in our event in Zurich last year, and that was the big issue, and people were concentrating on that. I, much like Kai, I'm a historian, so I'm tend to be reluctant about future prognosis. But I think what the recent past has shown is that there has to be a change in the politics of the association. And I think that this change, or I'm quite optimistic that this change will be coming, because I've seen so many different aspects of FIFA now, the other faces of FIFA than the ones that we're usually presented with in the press. And from there, I'm kind of optimistic that there is the will and also the the possibility for an internal change and towards more transparency and towards living up to the promise of the sport.
So a difference of opinion there. So I'll ask both of you to finish up. In David Goldblatt's essay, he writes at the end of the one World Cup of the past, the one match that he wishes he could have he could attend if he could travel through time. So I'll ask you both, which World Cup of the past, maybe even a particular match, do you wish you could attend personally? So Kai, do you have a favorite?
Yeah, the 54 final. I would have liked to attend this. You know, Germany Hungary. I would have liked to see this. And because of what it then meant in terms of the German politics of the past, the sort of sense of rebirth, I would have enjoyed to experience the weeks and the euphoria that followed.
Mm-hmm. And Stefan?
Yeah, in my case, it would have been the Maracanazo. Actually, I would really have loved to be there in 1950. I've known the old Maracana, and I know how impressive it can be there, and I can hardly understand how it was that quiet in that very moment. And I would have liked to be there and to experience that.
You've been listening to an interview with Stefan Rinke and Kai Schiller, editors of the volume of essays, The FIFA World Cup, 1930 to 2010, Politics, Commerce, Spectacle, and Identities, published in 2014 by Wallstein. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from philosophy to popular music. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your week.